Right around what years are we talking right now?
Well, I went there in 24 and graduated in 27. And in 26, the board talked to Dr. Machen. I think the professor of apologetics died. And they asked Dr. Machen to take the position of professor of apologetics. Well, of course, his field was New Testament, but he was working very directly in defense of the New Testament, defense of Christianity. And Dr. Machen didn't think he should leave his direct field, but they argued with him, the conservative members of the board, and persuaded him to agree to do it. And so he agreed he would accept it. But Princeton was the seminary of the Presbyterian Church in the USA. And the next summer, I guess that was after my second year, the General Assembly met in Baltimore, and the Assembly had to okay all elections to the board, which of course had been originally done in order to preserve the institutions, to have the church have a veto on any professor.
Yeah.
Well, now of course there were the representative Union Seminary and these others there, and I was there at the meeting at which Dr. J. Ross Stevenson talked like a bull, the way he talked about Machen and how they shouldn't elect Machen as professor of apologetics. Dr. Alice was the man who defended getting Dr. Machen. And Alice said, "This is said to be a peace assembly. Now why should we make a peace offering of Dr. Machen?" But, Stevenson tore into Machen. And the assembly voted to defer decision for a year on the matter. And one reason they couldn't get him, and Machen belonged to the Benham Club, which was an eating club in the seminary, which was almost like a fraternity. And all the leading modernists from Princeton Seminary were Benhams, and they wouldn't speak against the Benham in the assembly, though they'd all vote against him. But I heard him just tear into Machen there, and Mrs. Robert Dick Wilson was sitting in the gallery, and she told me there was an old gentleman sitting next to her, and as they tore into Machen, this man says, "Serves Machen right, serves Machen right. Look at the way he attacked dear Dr. Erdman." And she turned to him and said, "But Dr. So-and-so," she said, "didn't Dr. Erdman attack Machen first?" "Oh," he says, "we ought to forgive dear Dr. Erdman for that mistake." She was impressed by that. But it just showed the feeling. After that action was taken, they simply postponed it a year, but Dr. Machen said he wouldn't go further with it then. He said that it took take a tremendous amount of reading for him to move over into that other field, and after that, he just wasn't going to do it. And I don't think they would have confirmed him anyway, but that was the end of that particular matter. But it was when they were considering this that I was at the assembly in Baltimore, and I happen to find myself next to Henry Sloan Coffin. He's the uncle of the William Sloan Coffin you hear some about nowadays. But Henry Sloan Coffin was then the president of Union Seminary. He'd recently become president of Union Seminary. And the Union Seminary men were in there voting energetically against Machen's confirmation, of course. And I happened to find myself next to him and chatted about one or two things. I said to him, "Dr. Coffin, when is your election as president of Union Seminary going to be voted on by the General Assembly?" He threw himself up and he says, "Union Seminary is not subject to any ecclesiastical control." But as Dr. Machen pointed out, how inconsistent for them to take that stand. They had withdrawn from the church and become independent so as to avoid the church trying to keep them from going modernist. And for them then to go into the assembly and vote against Machen being confirmed in Princeton.
Yes.
And at that assembly, the Presbyterian banner, which was published in Pittsburgh, they gave every commissioner a copy of it. And in it, there was an article, "When the Professors Disagree." Dr. Robert Dick Wilson had spoken at a meeting in Oxford of students, and in the course of his talk had said, "Mirabile dictu." You know, the Latin, mirabile dictu, it was a common expression at that time. Strange to say, mirabile dictu. But what he said was taken down in shorthand. And whether the shorthand writer made a mistake, or whether the typist made a mistake, or whether the printer made a mistake. We don't know. But it came out in the printed thing as Mirabile Dicta. And T.R. Glover, the orator of Oxford University, was away at the time. And when he came back and he saw this, he wrote a blast. He says, they claim he knows 37 languages, but his Latin is atrocious. And so this was distributed to all of them, you see, to every commissioner. Well, after the General Assembly finished its meeting at Baltimore, I came back to Princeton and ran on to Dr. Machen there. Dr. Machen had, of course, not been at the meeting in Baltimore, but he had been reading about it in the papers. And I was very touched to see how deeply he took it to heart. I felt almost as if I were speaking to a condemned man, condemned by a court for a crime that he had not committed, and forsaken by all his friends, was about to be sent to the gallows. It really was pitiful to see how deeply hurt Dr. Machen was by it all. 3 days later, in Princeton, I ran onto Dr. Stevenson. And I can't see how he could have failed to have noticed that I was down there at the meeting in Baltimore. But when Dr. Stevenson saw me, oh, he says, you know, he says, I think we came out of that meeting pretty well in getting Machen's confirmation just postponed for 1 year. You know, some of those commissioners wanted to throw it out altogether because of his connection with liquor interests. Well, he didn't have any connection with liquor interests at all, but that just shows what they'd been whispering around, you see. And I very foolishly told Machen what Stevenson said to me, and he was just about ready to, because it was so utterly hypocritical. But, oh, you just got a feeling.
He didn't say anything to Stevenson at the time, though.
He would have, but Dr. Ellis caught him first. Did I tell Machen or did I tell Hodge? And he told Machen, I'm not sure. Anyway, Alice managed to calm him down before he spoke to Stevenson. The fur really would have flown. But then, eventually, the board sort of polarized. The modernists had control of the board of trustees, although there were some good, strong evangelicals in it. And some of them were also members of the board of directors. And the evangelicals had control of the directors. And about this matter of Dr. Machen being confirmed, I went up to see one of the directors one time to talk with him in my second year. Had a nice talk with him, a very fine man he was. And the minutes of the last director's meeting were laid out on the table. And he was called out for a minute or two, and I glanced at this on the table there, and I saw that they had proposed Frank Stevenson, pastor of the big Presbyterian church in Cincinnati, a man who, when the committee came to investigate Princeton Seminary, had made a strong stand, a true Christian stand for the seminary, and also a modernist man. The two had been nominated to be new directors. And I thought, oh my, wouldn't this be terrible if this modernist was elected? And so I went to Dr. Machen. And I suggested to Dr. Machen that he, for whom this director had tremendous regard, talk to him about the importance of that to prevent that. And Dr. Machen was quite upset. He said, that is an internal matter of the board of directors. The worst thing about it is that you should know anything about it. But he says, of course, if they did that, that would be suicidal. But then later I heard that some people said, wouldn't it be wonderful for us to bring in to the board at the same time two new men representing the two different views. Well, such utter lack of common sense, it seemed like. And they did elect the two of them. Mm-hmm. But Frank Stevenson saw what was happening. He was a very good, fine Christian man. And they, modernists, tried in 1929... to get the General Assembly to reorganize Princeton, because Princeton was the theological seminary of the Presbyterian Church and under control of the General Assembly. And they wanted the General Assembly to reorganize. They said, this is purely an administrative problem. You have two boards running it, and you have friction between the two boards. Now, the board of directors said, our place is to handle the faculty, the spiritual aspects, all that. The trustees are there to handle the money. Some of the same people were on both boards, but the modernists had the majority in the trustees, or modernists or people that wanted to be ecumenical. And the conservatives had of the board of directors. And they said, this is purely an administrative matter. Princeton will stand just as it's always stood. We want the church to have all views represented in it. There's other seminaries with other views, but this is the historic Princeton view. Of course, nobody's going to interfere with that. But of course, everybody knew they would.
They represented it to the General Assembly in 1929 as simply an administrative dispute between two boards, and the trustees wanted one thing and the directors another, and it's just an organizational thing, and we should combine the two boards and thus have a unified direction. And so they combined them in such a way that the modernists would have the control. And of course, then Dr. Wilson and Dr. Machen and the others withdrew. Oh, they wrote letter after letter to Wilson trying to get him to stay. I don't think anybody tried to get Machen to stay. But of course, Machen and Alice were fairly young, you see. They were only assistant professors. And the faculty was mostly pretty old at Princeton then.
And as one man said to me, he said, the majority of the Princeton faculty are getting along in years. And they said, the next 10 years, we'll see a complete change. So they said, what happens now is vital for the future.
And so the modernists knew that if these directors could get in new men like the men they had then, that there'd be another generation. So it was a very important thing right then to get rid of that one generally recognized scholarly institution that stood for fundamental Christianity.
You were in Germany at this point?
I was in Germany at that time.
Dr. Wilson got me a special fellowship to go to Germany and study, and I stayed there 2 years. And there, of course, you saw the unbelief and the denial of the scripture, and I was interested in the evidences for it, and I studied archaeology and Semitic languages. And then I heard that they were going to start a new seminary if the General Assembly reorganized Princeton Seminary.
But I didn't know just what was going to happen at Princeton, and I wanted to spend a third year there. The New York Times, when it got over there, was too early. The assembly hadn't yet met, so I didn't know what had happened in the assembly. They ran Dr. Wilson for moderator, and his wife told me, she says, while they defeated him for moderator, yet she said the people rallied around him, so it was almost a great time of celebration of him. And of course, everybody spoke well of him, but simply voted for the other people for moderator. I'm not sure who was elected moderator then, but I think it was rather pretty close right then. But if he was elected moderator, of course, he'd be expected to go around the country and speak everywhere. And he wrote me, and he said, if I'm elected moderator, he said, I certainly would need your help at Princeton. And he said, if we should start a new school, why, I certainly want your help. Well, I didn't know what was happening. The Paris edition of the New York Herald Tribune might or might not have something about the General Assembly. But by this time, whatever happened was passed, and I couldn't get access to the old issues of that. While the issues of the other, of the paper from over here, you see the two just crossed, so that I just couldn't get information. I got a note from Dr. Ellis, and he said, we're starting a new school, and of course Dr. Wilson wants you for his assistant, but he says, we need some books, would you go to Leipzig and buy some books for us? So I went down to Leipzig and bought the books. And then I wrote, and I said, I really think I should have another year over here. I thought maybe they would insist, you know, that I come right away. But a week or so passed. Of course, then mail was slow. A week or so passed, and I didn't have word. I went down to Austria and spent about 10 days at a place in Austria. And I left word with the American Express to forward my mail. And after the 10 days, I got no mail. So I went off, and I went through Italy and Austria and didn't see a person I knew for the next 3 weeks. And when I got back, there was a stack of mail this high, and they already had started the seminary, and the Sunday School Times has had an article about it and mentioned me as one of the faculty, and my folks in Los Angeles had written, we hear you're to be in the new faculty, we hope this is true, and so I sent a telegram to Dr. Wilson, and I said,
just received letters and telegrams. Hope other satisfactory arrangements made by this time. And I got a telegram back, teaching your courses till you arrive. And during those times, they had a meeting for getting interest for the starting of Westminster Seminary, and they had sent an inquiry. See, the American Express had gotten mail and failed to forward it for 10 days. And that's how I didn't get it, so then it piled up. Yeah. And so they sent over there to know where it was, and they said I was somewhere in Austria. But in one of the meetings, somebody got it mixed and said I was somewhere in Australia. But those were sad days as the devil just took over that great institution and took it away from us.
As I mentioned to you, I've always felt that the emphasis on basic Christianity is tremendously important. In Occidental, I faced a denial of Christianity. Although we had one or two very fine Christians on the faculty there at that time, they were a great blessing to me. Then at Biola, the emphasis was that way. And I think that the greatest blessing I got from Biola was the morning devotions by Mr. Hubbard. They really did affect me. I wish I had some notes on them. I remember only slightly what he said, but the general impression was very strong. And then next to that was Dr. Torrey's lectures on doctrine. They were very excellent. But that was the emphasis which I was used to there. Now, you say here about the Montrose Bible Conference, they say it was Dr. Torrey's wish personalities not be discussed. I incline to question that very seriously. I think that you'd have to ask the question two ways. I think Dr. Torrey would feel that Christians, like most people, have a tendency to get into discussing minor points about other people and gossiping about personalities, which is harmful and wrong, and if such a thing as that got started, he certainly would try to put a stop to it. But I do not believe Dr. Torrey would hesitate about naming names and pointing out particular problems if there was a matter of someone's loyalty to the truth. I know in the Montrose Bible Conference 30, 40 years ago, they had two or three upheavals. And there were various views held. And of course, I suppose everybody would want to quote Dr. Torrey if they could. But if the idea was we shouldn't say anything critical of anybody else, why, I recall a story that I heard once, which I don't know whether it's true or not, but I know that Dwight L. Moody got Dr. Torrey to work with him, and he worked with him for years. And at the Northfield Bible Conference, according to the story I heard, one time they had Henry Drummond, and Henry Drummond's book, The Greatest Thing in the World, his little book on love, was very widely read for a long time and highly spoken of among Christians. And according to the story that I heard, Drummond, in his messages, brought in considerable question about certain biblical accuracies and inclined toward the higher criticism in ways that Dr. Torrey spoke up very strongly against. And according to what I heard, one man said, well, Dwight L. Moody said, well, Drummond shows a much better spirit than Torrey does. But the other person there, who also knew them well, said, well, he said, I don't know whether Moody said that or not, but I do know that Moody never had Drummond back after Torrey made his criticism of him. So it's rather hard sometimes to analyze people's attitudes on things like that, but
that at least was not one of Dr. Torrey's distinctives, or that doesn't ring a bell.
No. Dr. Torrey was very forthright. He was very forthright. He stood very out and out on all the biblical points. Yes, and he belonged to the Congregational Church, and he was ordained in the Congregational Church, which Moody had belonged to, and he was an evangelist, but a Congregationalist. And then when the Congregationalist Convention adopted a statement which was not thoroughly true to the scripture, he left and asked for admission to the presbytery. So he was a Presbyterian minister in the latter years of his life. When they were trying to destroy Princeton Seminary, I visited Torrey
in Chicago as I was passing through, and I told him about this, and he said, oh, he says, I wish I could get to that next Presbyterian Assembly where that's going to come up. He says, I'd make the fight of my life to try to save Princeton Seminary. Now, I talked to Dr. Torrey once, and I said, I don't know whether to come back to Biola for a second year or to go to Princeton Seminary. He says, I'd love to have you get the second year of our course at Biola, but he says, I wouldn't want you to miss getting the course under those great defenders of the faith there at Princeton. He says, there's no place in the world today that would be so helpful for you to go as there. Well, then, when I heard the public announcement that he had resigned from the Biola Institute of Los Angeles, I said, well, that settles it. I'll go to Princeton next year. So I went to Princeton.
I'd like just to say word that Princeton is not at all unique. There has been a process going on for a long, long time. God's people found schools and then unbelievers take them over. And I think one of the earliest, very strong cases of that was Harvard Divinity School at Harvard University, which chose a man who didn't believe in the deity of Christ as professor of theology shortly after 1800. And the result was that a group from there went to Andover and started a seminary at Andover in Massachusetts. And the Andover Seminary grew to be so strong that by about 1860 or 70, sometime along then, they had a meeting of alumni and missionary pastors where they had over 1,000 who had graduated from there, who told how wonderfully the Lord was using their witness in different parts of this country and in many mission fields. And then the modernists got in, and eventually they took over Andover completely. They even had a big celebration in which they accused one of themselves of being a fundamentalist and had a mock trial. And Andover, which had been a very large and influential theological seminary, sank in size until they had only a very few students, and the board united them with Harvard. And so Harvard named its theological library the Andover Library and put the Andover books into it and took the Andover endowment. When Harvard became modernistic, of course, a great many very godly men who had received their training at Harvard couldn't believe this had happened. And so they would send their children to Harvard, and they would come out unbelievers. And so a large segment of American Christianity was destroyed early in the last century. But then gradually people became aware of it, and they went to Andover or to Yale, which continued to be thoroughly evangelical for many years after Harvard had gone modernist. I believe it was in the present century before Yale was completely in the hands of the modernists. But I visited Yale Divinity School in the 20s, and it was completely in the modernist hands at that time. But they had quite a number of students from very fine Christian backgrounds. One man said, one day he said in class, they show that the Gospel of John is not dependable. I feel I must cut that out of the Bible. The next day they cut out the book of Ephesians, and he went on. I urged him to come to Princeton, but he stayed there. Didn't come, and I suppose came out an unbeliever. But now, I would think that at the turn of the century, there were probably 50 at least of fine theological seminaries in the country that believed in the inerrancy of God's Word. And most of them have been taken over. And in most cases, the boards were chosen with men who could contribute money or who could get support, and they had confidence in the school, and they sent their people to study under great scholars in Germany or elsewhere. And these would come back with very pious statements, but gradually it would be changed. And in Princeton, it is my impression, perhaps as early as 1904, at least it was a long time ago, that Dr. Purvis, who was professor of New Testament, was called to be pastor of the big Fifth Avenue Presbyterian Church, and the board elected a graduate of Princeton to be professor of New Testament, who was a professor in Hartford Theological Seminary. Mm-hmm. And he wrote a letter back to them in which he told them that he wouldn't think of teaching at a school that held to such old-fashioned, out-of-date ideas as complete dependability of the Bible and so on. But it showed me the way it could easily have gone on the skids even then. But, of course, there was Dr. Warfield, who was known for his strong defense of the Scripture, and Robert Dick Wilson was a very great defender of the Old Testament. Then, of course, a younger man, Dr. Machen, came along, who took a strong stand. Their writings attracted people to Princeton. With such great Christians as this on the faculty at Princeton, Princeton Seminary had a great reputation as a scholarly institution. The result was that when, as most of the other old-line seminaries were gone, the modernists spread the word around the country that Christianity, as it had been historically held, was an old-fashioned, out-of-date mythology, and no really intelligent person held it, people would point to Princeton Seminary, and there was no answer they could give. It became very important for them then to try in some way to wreck the witness of Princeton Seminary. And now there was quite a change at this time in the student body of Princeton. The student body was more or less equally divided. On the one hand, there were those who wanted to stand for Orthodox Christianity who were attracted by the scholarship of men like Warfield, Wilson, and Machen. On the other hand, there were a great many men there who were the sons of alumni of Princeton, but who had gone to denominational colleges where they had been given an awful lot of unbelief, and they came to the seminary as a profession. That group really believed practically nothing, as far as I could see, except that here was a good job that they were heading for.
The faculty is all sound at this point.
At this point, the faculty would all claim to be very sound. They would all claim to be. And some of them, I wasn't altogether sure whether they were simply repeating things they'd heard before. And some of them were very strongly conservative in their beliefs on the Bible.
In the classes, the bulk of what we got was good, solid, sound stuff, I would say.
But they got a new president. I don't know when, maybe 1915, something like that. J. Ross Stevenson. He was a graduate of McCormick, not of Princeton. And he was determined to bring Princeton in line with the other great educational institutions. He was a great man for uniting things, ecumenical movement, getting denominations together. But he knew the lingo, so he could give the strongest evangelical address you'd ever hear when he was in a crowd where that was the thing to do.
Did the board choose him?
Yes, the board chose him.
And they didn't realize?
I guess they didn't. I know two or three of the leaders of the board were soon very anxious to get rid of him, but they didn't see how they could do it.
Yes.
But the board was divided.
Uh-huh.
And it was about 1910 or 1912 that the Stewart brothers, the founders of the Union Oil Company, gave money to get out a series of booklets they called The Fundamentals. And that's where the name Fundamentalist came from. From those booklets that they sent out, I think there were about 20 of them. And later they were combined into four volumes, a set called The Fundamentals.
The term fundamentalist was not used before that time, as far as you know?
As far as I know, it never was used before that. As far as I know, it started with that. The term fundamentalist, of course, is used in most sciences today. Mm-hmm. They will talk of the fundamentalists in economics. They are the ones who want to get down to the ground, solid ground, and get the facts and stand on them. And it's a good term in everything except in religion. But in religion, it has come to be a term for those who follow the line held by these booklets, which were put out at that time. And, of course, people have ridiculed. It's funny how they ridicule the term fundamentalism in religion and how it's a sign of honor in any other field of thought. But the pamphlets awakened a great many people to the trend and the way things were going throughout the country. And, of course, there were dozens of great, fine Christian colleges that the modernists had completely taken over by that time, and many people were very upset about it. But this sort of galvanized and crystallized it.
One more question about the pamphlets. Was this of mixed distinctives, the men who put out the background or the pamphlets?
Yes, I believe
Baptists and Presbyterians and others.
I think it was fundamentally Presbyterian, but the pamphlets were definitely simply the historic Christian doctrines.
I don't think that they went into theology aside from the great fundamentals in these pamphlets. I haven't ever gone through all of them, but that's my impression of them. But with that, with the way that the thing came more into prominence, there was a series of articles in the World's Work magazine, which was a magazine that was very well thought of in the early 20s. And this series of articles was on the fundamentalist controversy. And they would refer to two institutions, Princeton and Moody Bible Institute. And they would say, Moody Bible Institute, for instance, entrance requirement, high school education or equivalent. And they did that about 10 times in the course of the articles. But when they would refer to Princeton, it's the only seminary they referred to, you see. And when they would refer to it, of course, they had to admit that there was a scholarly standard there. But they downplayed that as much as they could. And so the result was that there were students who went to Princeton from many different backgrounds. There were students from probably 30 different denominations there who had come for the solid Christian teaching, for the defense of the scripture. But there was also at least half of the student body made up of these fellows who were pretty well conditioned in college to take Christianity pretty much as just a veneer and a job. And among them, there was a small amount of drinking and a certain amount of lurid pictures on their walls and that sort of thing. I didn't have a great deal of contact with those folks for that. But then I think one thing that perhaps crystallized it, Dr. Machen was invited to preach in the First Presbyterian Church in Princeton to fill in for a time, a supply preacher. And he preached some very strong sermons on the rise of modernism. Out in Los Angeles, we read in the newspaper how Henry Van Dyke stalked out of the meeting and said that what Machen was giving was a bilious travesty of the gospel. Things were getting sort of tense there when I went there. Mm-hmm. Well, I got there, and we had the inaugural sermon. Incidentally, the faculty later on told me they were all upset because they said that Dr. Stevenson picked the speakers in all the main occasions, and they said the faculty was teaching one thing through the year, and then they had the speakers who took a different tack altogether. No direct clash, but it undermined. But the opening address was given by Dr. Zwemer, the veteran missionary from the Muslim lands. And Dr. Zwemer, I thought, gave a very fine presentation of a great many central Christian truths. And he stressed the great evangelical message and witness and all that. After he spoke, I had mentioned Dr. Machen. I said, that was a great message he gave. Well, Dr. Machen says he always stands for the moderns in the assemblies. And Dr. Zwemer, in his doctrine, was absolutely straight down the line. But Dr. Zwemer was so anxious to get the message out, to do the missionary work, that he would cooperate with anybody, whatever. And so Dr. Machen was quite suspicious of him.
Yeah.
And he was standing right with Dr. J. Ross Stevenson and these others, you see, in ecclesiastical things. The result was that when Dr. Zwemer gave a course in Mohammedan apologetics, and there were two courses he gave, which were on presenting the gospel to Muslims, and I knew I would get much of tremendous value from them. So I took the two courses, and all the other conservative students were leery of him. So I was the only conservative in the class. And the rest of the class was made up of these fellows who were strongly liberal in their outlook. And they got into the course, and Dr. Zwemer would give illustrations how to present the doctrine of the Trinity, illustrations of the value of the Bible for missionary work and so on. And I was just thrilled with it. And everybody else in the class sort of looked puzzled. How could such an intelligent fellow as Zwemer hold such crazy ideas? Really, it was a mixed-up situation. But there was a man named H. McAllister Griffiths, you may have heard of sometime, who was a student there, who had, when a student at the University of California, challenged a modernist professor to debate on Daniel. And this modernist professor from a modernist seminary out there had accepted it. And then he found that Griffiths had Dr. Wilson's books and was studying and getting good material. And
he pleaded some excuse and stepped out of it. And the story around was that he was so embarrassed at not being willing to debate this student that he went over to Palestine in order to get a reputation as a great excavator in order to offset it. I don't know how much is truth to that. But my roommate there had been a friend of mine in college, and he was the student body president. And there was an invitation came to the student body there to go to a meeting of representatives of seminary student bodies in order to form an organization under the YMCA, an organization of seminary students. And my roommate, as student body president,
what was his name now?
Woodbridge Johnson. He later turned completely against all he believed at that time. But he went, and Griffith went, and a younger man named Tom Coyle. They're all three deceased now. But they went as representing Princeton. And when I saw Woodbridge when he came back, I says, well, did you have a good... Oh, he said, it was awful. He says, it's good to be back with God's people again. Well, they had a meeting of the student body, and they reported. And they said that they got to this meeting, and they said, now, we're going to form an organization, all these seminaries, to have fellowship and cooperation. Someone said, let's just pretend that we are a group of denominations. And let's form our platform as to what the denominations ought to unite on in uniting to one church. And so he said they got to discussing the platform, and one point after another, somebody couldn't believe that, and somebody couldn't accept this, and somebody couldn't accept the other thing. And finally he said, somebody said, well, let's just unite on John 3:16. And then some of them spoke up and they said, we couldn't agree to that. They said, we don't believe in that about the only begotten Son of God. And he said, others says, oh, don't worry about that. When you exegete it properly, you get rid of that idea. Well, I don't know if it hadn't been these three particular fellows. See, if it had been three from the other group of the seminary, they might have just gone along. But they came back and brought this report, and maybe a third to half of the student body was very much aroused about this and decided, as a student body, we certainly should not unite in such an organization. Well, they brought a man down then to speak to our student body who was one of the nicest fellows you ever saw. And he told about how much good is done by these different people in these different seminaries and all that. But the student body voted against going into it. And then they said that at the meeting there were two other seminaries with which they had real fellowship. And I'm afraid those two have gone today. Well, it isn't as Princeton has, all three of them. But these two seminaries, they had real fellowship there. And they really believed. One of them was a Lutheran seminary and one was a Moravian. And they said, we ought to make a witness, get together with seminaries that do. So they decided to form this League of Evangelical Students. Well, now, they sent out a letter to a lot of seminaries, to the student body, inviting them to join with them in this. I think this inter-seminary group is still in existence. I mean, the modernist one. Well, it seems to me we got an invitation within the last 3 or 4 years to send a representative.
Yes.
I think I did recommend that somebody go as an observer, which I thought would be a good tonic for him. But they said, let's form an organization, and they sent the letters out to these other schools, inviting them. And the letterhead had on it the name of Dr. Charles R. Erdman, who was professor of practical theology, I believe. He was a man who wanted to be friends with everybody, absolutely everybody. Dr. Erdman began to get letters from these other seminaries. Do you believe in this sort of thing? Is this what you want to stand with? And he said that that was embarrassing him. But they insisted on writing these letters and taking this stand. And the result was that the students asked that the faculty give them a different faculty representative. And the faculty had a heated meeting in which, by a very slim margin, they voted to not have Dr. Erdman be the faculty representative, which he'd been for years. Well, then they had a big headline, I believe, in the Philadelphia Daily Paper, Charles Erdman ousted. He had been removed from his position, but it was thought he might still continue to teach at Princeton.
And somebody up there said, isn't it a shame they have to wash all their dirty linen in public?
Yeah.
But here, the Philadelphia papers and some of the New York papers had a lot of these awful things that were supposed to be happening at Princeton. And a committee from the General Assembly came one time to investigate the seminary. And they were very exciting days. But how the League of Evangelical Students operated, what my role in was, what effect it had on the Princeton student body, and oh, and should such a league be formed in the future and under what circumstances? So there's a lot of different questions, but it's largely my opinion rather than factual information.
Mm-hmm.
How it operated, that of course was a problem. The way it operated was volunteer activity on the part of busy seminary students, and I was national secretary, which meant principally that I wrote the minutes and did a certain amount of correspondence. But they got someone to be sort of a general secretary. They had a fellow from up at Calvin who wrote letters to a lot of schools and tried to get them to cooperate and did some good work, but I think he lost interest for very long, because that was sort of a flash in the pan, you might say.
Yeah.
And it did have two or three national conventions. Oh, I guess it had more later when I didn't have much to do with it, but it had two or three that were pretty good. And as far as the Princeton student body is concerned, about a third of the Princeton student body was violently against it. About a third was strongly for it, and about a third could be swayed one way or the other. So we never were able to persuade the student body to take an action, to go into it as a body, while several of these others did, as you know. But they had the president and secretary, both from Princeton, of course. It was a great subject of controversy when we were there, but it was really just a small part of the big controversy as to whether Princeton would go like nearly all the other old line seminaries had gone, or whether it could yet be saved. So otherwise, I don't think it had much effect on Princeton student body. And of course, it was formed along the end of my first year in seminary, and it was rather active my second and third years. Then I was 2 years in Germany and had no contact with it, so I don't know anything about what happened during that time. Then after that, I don't remember much about it during the 8 years I was at Westminster, but a couple of years later, I believe they had a convention in Philadelphia. It was a pretty good meeting. And then I didn't hear much about it, and I kind of forgot it and all the other things that were happening. Now, the idea, should such a league be formed? Now, if you could get sound seminaries or real fundamentalist seminaries, seminaries that believe in the Word of God, if you could get students from them to have meetings for mutual discussion of problems and so on, I can see how that could be very helpful. But in a way, the work it was attempting to do, that gap was to some extent filled a little bit after that by the beginning of the InterVarsity, because the InterVarsity began to establish chapters and colleges all over the country, and I don't know, just they talked about trying to get them in the liberal seminaries. In the conservative seminaries, there was the Foreign Mission Fellowship founded by Columbia Bible College, which gathered together a certain interchange between some of our seminaries. I don't know how much, I wasn't really a great deal connected with that. But, of course, the InterVarsity, one of their leaders said to me one time, he said, the great danger is that it becomes merely an organization for gathering Christians, and we want it to be something that will be reaching people for Christ. But I think the gathering was worthwhile too. For instance, you go in the University of California, where the teaching is mostly atheistic and the whole general trend is anti-Christian, and yet among those thousands of people there would be a substantial number from Christian homes who have a Christian faith and want to hold on to it and may think they're the only people. University, and something that brings them together is worthwhile. But that's not really what the event, this particular league, was formed for.
Well, was it formed to have discussions mostly, or to, what was it, what was its real job in its
life? Yes, yes. It received its impetus from the inter-seminary organization that the YMCA founded. And when they went to that, they found the purpose there was to have discussions and mutual interchange among the students of different seminaries, and they sort of took a hold there and went on from there. But of course, to that they added the idea very strongly that we are making a testimony of a stand for the scripture as against those that deny it, and that became more or less central.
And then, of course, there were new organizations that came up that had the Stand for the Faith as their big positive purpose, and that kind of overshadowed it, too.
Yeah.
But the Stand became an important part of its activity, and the faculty at Princeton was very divided over it, as I mentioned. And in the faculty, some of them said, but there are organizations there that aren't Calvinistic, there are seminaries that don't stand for the true doctrines, and there are seminaries there that have low scholarly standards. Should our students enter into fringe with them? And Caspar Wister Hodge, I'm told, in the faculty meeting, spoke up and said, if an old washerwoman coming down the street wants to make a testimony for Christ, you shouldn't stop her and say, you're not educated, you can't do this. He says, there's no reason we can't unite for testimony for Christ with people of like precious faith, regardless of their differences on denominational doctrines or of their amount of education. But that was just a rebuttal of an attack upon it, as you see right then. And then, of course, we got into the big struggle within the denomination to try to hold the denomination.
Right.
I hardly thought of the people I knew with Occidental or the experiences there or anything. I was so busy with many things. But in recent years, I've been thinking back over my life more. And I must say, as I think of it, the 5 years that I had at Occidental are perhaps as pleasant as any years I've ever had in my life. I learned a tremendous lot at Princeton Seminary and had very valuable experiences, but just for an enjoyable experience, those 5 years at Occidental were as interesting and valuable to me as any I ever had. Now, I don't know altogether what the reason for that is. I remember shortly before I graduated, somebody said, my, it's wonderful the fellowship we have here. He said, you can't have fellowship like this later on when people are in their life work. They're more obsessed with the problems they have to face and with their particular situations and so on. Now, it struck me as a strange thing when he said it. I don't know whether that enters into it at all, but the fact of being rather carefree, enjoying classes, enjoying fellowship and so on. But one thing I liked particularly there, I think, was the fact that it was a small institution. We had about 500 students. Now, we had, I think, a very scholarly faculty. We had a very good faculty. But with a small institution like that, you could know a lot of those people. And also you could have the opportunity to get a little experience in various phases of activity. For instance, I got on the debating team the first year. Well, some debating every year. And my fourth year, I was editor of the school paper, which was 8 pages every week. It was a big job, but it gave contact. One had an opportunity to get a little bit of a lot of different kinds of experiences. And then there was a lot of school politics, which you knew about, and you had occasional interesting connections with in one way or another. As I say, all in all, well, I very eagerly look forward to the coming of the alumni journals and look in them for any news about people, even that I knew very slightly when I was there. But Occidental, before I went there, had a reputation for being a very fine Christian college. And I believe that it was. I think probably 3 or 4 years before I went, it had been outstandingly Christian. And the process of its becoming modernistic had already begun when I entered, but hadn't yet gone so very far. The rules about social life were fairly strict. And the situation was such that a Christian could participate in just about all the college activities. There was none of them in which there was that you would feel you must keep apart from. And so, as I say, when I entered, the only unbelief as far as was recognized was that some of the science professors were inclining toward evolution. And one of the men, I think was one of the deans, remarked to me once that since there were questions from time to time about their science department, they were very careful to see that their humanities departments were all very definitely biblical and so on. Well, that situation was not as definitely so as he thought. They had a professor of philosophy, although he came from a wonderful Christian family, very fine Christian background. His views were very, very far from Orthodox Christianity. His influence was quite strong. And while I was there, they got new members of the English department who were quite remote from Christian views. But in general, the teaching was pretty much true to the scripture.
Why did they get these ones that were more liberal? Who was responsible for that?
In any institution, your leadership has to think of two things. They have to think of getting sufficient funds and material support to keep the thing going and to build it up as they'd like. They have to think of their standing. And they were anxious to get people with standing. They had a good academic standing. They wanted to keep it. They wanted to raise it. The trustees were probably largely good Christian people who were anxious to maintain a good Christian college. Though, even when I entered, one member of the Board of Trustees was Dr. Freeman of the First Presbyterian Church of Pasadena, a graduate of Princeton Seminary, but I never heard of any really Christian teaching that he ever gave. But I think it was quite a while before people caught on to the fact his teaching wasn't Christian. He had a lot of pious terminology and a beautiful Scotch brogue, and people just loved to hear him preach. But the bulk of your trustees in most institutions don't have much theological understanding in most institutions. Someone said to me once that he said, it's very important who is picked for a college president, because he said, if a man succeeds as a college president, he can get just about whoever he wants onto the faculty and also onto the board. And as a matter of fact, see, my first year there, it was the second year, I think, of a new president, Silas Evans, who had been president, I believe, of Ripon College in the Middle West. I don't know why they got him, how they came to get him. He was just filled with pious terminology. He would say, if Jesus Christ is not Lord of all, he is not Lord at all. And he was full of pious terminology, but the main import of his teaching was definitely anti-Christian. In fact, he tried to change the college too fast and provoked reaction against him. And so after he'd been there 2 years, at the end of my first year, he resigned. And then for my next 2 years there, the dean, who was a good Christian man, was acting president. But he was kind of up in the air philosophically. My father used to love his Bible class. And he had some rather involved, complicated things that, as far as I know, were strictly Christian. But they were not Christian in the simple sense of the word. They were rather involved. But he was a fine man. But he was for 2 years, and then they got a new president who had been assistant professor of church history in Princeton Seminary, and then had been professor of church history in the Presbyterian Seminary near San Francisco. And so, of course, I think they assumed that he was thoroughly Christian. But he came in definitely determined to make it an effective modern college that wouldn't be tied to old-fashioned ideas. I think that what Evans tried to do and failed, because he went too fast, this man went a little slower, and also things had gone further the time he got there, and he was able to succeed. He was president 15 or 20 years, I don't know. I had no use whatever for him. Evans, though, it was interesting. My first year, I had courses in Bible from Evans, and Evans would talk about a freshman's idea of Jesus, how interesting it was to read the papers. See a freshman's idea of Jesus. And I thought much more important to learn what a freshman ought to think about Jesus. It's so subjective. And I didn't have much use for his teaching. He would refer to some conservative concept. He'd say, of course, I know how you people are out here on the Pacific coast. As if we were a little queer out on the Pacific coast with our antiquated ideas, you know. But I had a Bible from him one semester, I think, and from this philosopher I mentioned, Wyman, one semester. Wyman was the man who came from a marvelous conservative background with wonderful, fine Christians in his family. But I would not say that he believed any Christian idea. I would not say so. There was a big difference between the two. With Evans, in an exam, I would say the professor has said, and then I would give his view. Exactly. But by saying the professor has said, I would dissociate myself from saying what I thought about it. While with Wyman, I would say the professor has said, and then give what he said, then I'd say, but it seems this way to me, and I'd give what I thought. And Wyman liked that. He wanted you to think. And the students used to say, oh, they said, Wyman doesn't care what you think. He's not interested what your ideas are. He's just interested in teaching you to think. But you notice that at the end of the course, 9/10 of those who studied much from Wyman came out with ideas that were a carbon copy of his. But he was very, very clever in getting his ideas across. After he left there, he became professor at the University of Chicago. And one time at the University of Chicago, I was preparing a course on Proverbs, which I was going to give the next year in seminary. And I was working at the Oriental Institute in Archaeology. So I went over to the Divinity School, and I tell them I'm working at the Oriental Institute, which was 3 blocks away, and I'd like to take a couple of books out, and I'd take them. But then one day I saw a notice up which said the Divinity School Library will be closed. Starting next week, it will be closed for the rest of the summer. No books can be taken out in the rest of the summer. Books that are already out can be returned through the main university library. So I thought, I'd like to get a lot of books now. So I went in the stacks and I came out with 20 books on Proverbs. And I went up to the librarian, a man who I didn't know at all, and I looked up the schedule and saw that Wyman was just finishing the last hour of a course he was giving, just as I went in, it so happened. So I went up to the librarian and I said, I'm working over at the Oriental Institute and I would very much like to take out these 20 books and return them through the main library. And of course that's a good bit to ask when they don't know you at all. And he looked very skeptical. And I said, I know one of your professors here. I think he would probably vouch for me. And he said, I noticed Dr. Wyman's just finishing a class. I think he would. He says, bring him in. So I went out and I found Wyman in the hall, just coming out of his class. And I told him what I wanted. He came up there. He strode into the room, turned to the librarian. He says, Mr. McRae was a student of mine for 5 years at Occidental. He says, he's orthodox, but he's honest in spite of his orthodoxy. And he strode out. The librarian says, what a wonderful recommendation. I couldn't see what was wonderful about it, but he let me take the books anyway. But that summer, I saw quite a little of Wyman occasionally, and his philosophic theories were all very much... one time in class, he gave a definition, God is a system of such and such and such and such. And so I said, what do you mean by a system? And then he said, a system is, and he gave a long definition. And then in the course of that, he used another long word. And I said, what do you mean by that? And he gave a definition. So I said, well, then would you say God is? And I put the three of them together so as to make about 60 words that was quite meaningless. He said, well, you could say it that way if you wanted, but he said, I wouldn't say it that way. One day, at Chicago, he said to me, he says, what this world needs is regeneration through the Holy Spirit. I said, what do you mean by regeneration by the Holy Spirit? Oh, he said, that's very simple. When a person becomes a member of a Christian community, there's an interaction between his character and the character of other members of the community. And that's what I call regeneration by the Holy Spirit. But you see, when he'd use this pious language, he would deceive people and gradually lead them into his ideas. But he was an interesting fellow, and I always enjoyed being with him, but I felt he was a very detrimental influence in college. After I'd been out a couple of years, I went back, and a man who was then his assistant, who later became head of the philosophy department at Harvard University, saw me coming through the hall, and he yelled, here comes a fundamentalist. He believes in the virgin birth. Now, I don't think Wyman would ever do anything like that. I mean, he wasn't crude like that. But the fact that his assistant would speak that way. Yeah. Oh, yes, another time I came back and Wyman had a new assistant who just graduated from Union Seminary. And he said, I look on McRae as sort of a lost soul. Under my teaching 4 years, I'm still a fundamentalist. But you can see a little influence like that in a college could gradually change things. And Wyman was a very pernicious influence. But an interesting fellow. He was not like these folks up at Cornell that won't hold a debate with you because everybody knows what they believe is true anyway, so why bother? Wyman would discuss anything.
under the influence of this teaching, a lot of students did change their views and become liberal. Do you have any reasons why you didn't? Because through all this, you stayed very firm.
Well, it's a strange thing. It's a very strange thing. I am naturally of a skeptical disposition. I naturally question everything. And before I went there, I was fortunate to have attended quite a lot of good Christian sermons and to have a good, sound fundamentalist background. Though I didn't have any depth of scholarship in it, I had pretty clear ideas. And I looked at the ideas that they gave, and I looked at them skeptically. And when I graduated, I felt that they had not proved their ideas, but they had shaken my confidence in my ideas. And I made the statement somewhere about the time I was graduating. I said, I hope that I won't have any real positive opinions on anything till I'm 50, and I hope by that time I'll have sense enough not to have any. I don't think that really represented my attitude. I still believed what I had before, but I didn't know how to defend it, really. But of course, there's this about it. I never tried to convert the professors. There was one fellow, I think he'd only had 2 years of high school, and then he quit, and he was out working some way, and then he was converted. He went to the Bible Institute and took the pastor's course for 3 years. And he came to Occidental within 1 or 2 years of when I finished. He went to the authorities and told them he'd passed the 3-year course in the Bible Institute, so they gave him a high school diploma. Then he came to Occidental and he asked them for some credit for his work at the Bible Institute, and they gave him 6 hours credit for it. And then he went to San Francisco Theological Seminary, and they gave him a year's credit for his work. So he said he didn't lose a minute by his time. But when he came, he was absolutely convinced he knew everything. And he was in a geology class I was in. And when we would go on a field trip, he would immediately start in trying to convince the professor that evolution was wrong. He had read some pamphlet by somebody against evolution, and he would say, oh, but so-and-so and so-and-so, you see. And the professor was a very shrewd fellow who would lead him on, until he'd get him to make an absurd statement or something that you could easily prove was untrue. And, of course, when the professor knew 6 times as much about the subject as he did, it was rather silly to think that he would be able to change the professor, prove the professor was wrong. Now, I always sort of took the attitude of sitting back and listening and judging. But he went in there to convince them. Oh, he was a fine preacher, and he was a personal worker. He was a really earnest, effective Christian worker when he went to Occidental. After this professor in geology made him feel like a fool several times, he began to change. And he was there 1 or 2 years when I was there. And then I went to the Bible Institute for a year. The Bible Institute then, they had a Professor McGinnis teaching, who was just hepped on philosophy. And I don't think he was a particularly good influence in the Institute. In fact, they had a big blow-up 3 or 4 years later, and he was out. But he was a very bright fellow, and I believe entirely loyal to the Scripture, and he did have material that was just the answer to a lot of things I'd gotten at Occidental. My year at the Bible Institute there was very, very beneficial to me. I didn't change my ideas on anything there, but I reached a stronger conviction and a positiveness and a certainty about it. But to mention this fellow Supke again, when I finished my year at the Institute and I went back and visited Occidental and I saw him, and I mentioned to him that I was going to go to Princeton Seminary next year. Oh, he says, what are you going to do that for? He says, I looked over these catalogs, and he says, I'm going to San Francisco Seminary. He says, I looked over a lot of catalogs, and he says, most of them, he says, they are studying together to learn the truth and so on. He says, Princeton Seminary catalog, they've got the truth. They're just giving you the truth. And he says, they got a lot of old-fashioned ideas. They're just laying down to you. He says, I don't know why you go there. He says, you're chasing dreams. He said, I know what I want. I want to be pastor of a big church in Southern California. And he says, I'm going to San Francisco Seminary, and I'm going to be that. And he says, sometime when you're chasing dreams, sometime when you're up in Alaska where it's frozen and cold, I'll let you come down and preach for me for a month and get warmed up and get a little bit of money. He says. Well, he not only changed his views, but he changed his character. Where he was interested in serving the Lord and accomplishing for him, he was now interested in getting a good church and getting a good living. That is one of the clearest instances I've ever seen of the way a man has been completely turned around by college. Well, now, he gave every evidence of being an earnest Christian. And I certainly don't believe he was a hypocrite. So whether he said words, didn't realize their implication, and hadn't really believed in the Lord and wasn't saved, or whether he was led astray so that his life produced wood, hay, and stubble rather than gold and silver, and before his death came to realize his errors, I don't know. But I certainly saw the change in that fellow's life. I've seen changes in many people, but usually I've only seen a little bit. But here was one who I saw the two stages so very, very clearly. But Occidental was a strong influence, perhaps all the more because it was gradual influence. Now, Wyman, he did like to get people to arguing. And he'd have a class of 60, a class in logic, and he would give you about five questions, like, what is the relation of science and religion? Something like that, rather vague, perhaps more definite than that. Every class, he would announce five subjects. Then everybody was supposed to write a couple hundred words on any one of these you chose. And then you come to class, he would read the roll. There were 50 or 60 in the class, and you'd say yes or no whether you had written a paper. And then he'd call at random people to read their papers. So one time, just for fun, I took one of his questions and I wrote two papers taking diametrically opposite positions. And there was a girl there, a flapper type, you know, that never studied and always was looking for some way of getting by. And I think this is the only time I spoke to her, but she sat right in front of me. And I said, so, would you like a paper this morning? I have two of them. She said, oh, could I have one? So I gave her one. And what did he do? But call on both of us to read our papers. And the papers clashed so positively that he was trying to get us into a debate, and she didn't know anything about it. But he was lots of fun. I remember once when I was at Occidental, a professor of history expressed a certain view about immigration. And then I was in a class in a different course, and the subject of immigration came up, and I said, what would you think of such and such? And I gave the idea this man had expressed in class, but I didn't say where I got it. And the professor says, nobody has such an idea as that. Well, I said, there are people who say that. He says, nobody of any sense says such a thing. Well, I didn't say anything more. But of course, if I said, Professor so-and-so says, why? Of course, I may have misunderstood the man in the first place. I may have unintentionally misquoted him. But it was rather humorous to see the reaction. But, of course, there was another thing in the college. There was the incoming of worldliness. They had fraternities. They were all local then. They later became national. But these fraternities, I think, were a very bad influence. But one fellow who came from a fine Christian background, here's another case. He came from a very fine Christian background, wanted to give his life to the Lord's service. He joined one of these fraternities. And eventually, well, he went into some kind of business and so on. He had a brother who went, I think, to Wheaton and then Princeton Seminary and became pastor of a big church there, who has a reputation for being a sound man. I imagine he is. But this fellow was awfully nice fellow, wonderful chap. But all these fraternities were after him. And he joined this one that had the reputation of being the most foul one on the campus at the time. Well, there were only two when I entered. There were, I think, four or five when I left. But he said to me, if the fellows in that fraternity followed the words of their initiation ceremony, they'd all be missionaries and ministers. So evidently, it was formed by good, godly Christian people. But by that time, worldliness had come in. And I remember my senior year, when I was elected editor of the paper, the man who was a member of this fraternity, the Alwyn Key fraternity, they called it, was elected student body president. This in the spring, he'd been elected. And the new president of the college, Remsen Bird, came and invited him, the new student body president, to have dinner with him. He told someone in my hearing, he said, I just thought I'd feel out what his attitude would So he says, I pulled a cigarette out of my pocket and lit it, he says. And he rather expected that the new president would be terribly shocked if the student body president would smoke. He says, he ran all over the place looking for an ashtray for me.
Do you think that the fraternities would not have been allowed to come in if the administration had been watching more carefully? Or?
Well, now, I became connected very soon after I got there with some very fine Christian fellows. And I was associated with them quite a lot during that first year. And they decided to form a house club, which they called the Kennelon Club. I don't know where they got the name. But they called it the Kennelon Club, and they got a house. And I lived only a mile and a half away, so sometimes I'd stay at the house and sometimes at home. And they were all good, earnest Christian fellows in this Kennelon Club. And in my, was it my senior year or my graduate year? Because I went back for a year and took a master's degree there. Why, the professor of English, who had been there a year or two, who would in class discuss the literary merits and demerits of the Lord's Prayer, you know, that sort of thing. See, it was all strictly from a literary viewpoint. So all these fine Christian people couldn't object to anything he said because it was purely from a literary viewpoint. And I think he probably did more harm than a teacher of Bible who would come direct on with an attack. But one day, he said he wanted to see me. And he said, your group, he says, in the Kennelon Club there, you've got the best chance of any group in the college to become a national fraternity. Now, he says, I've connected with a named certain national fraternity, and I will recommend you folks, if you want to apply for it, and he says, all these local fraternities, they will just be nothing once you have a national fraternity on the campus. And he says, you folks have got more scholarship and more athletic ability and so on than any other group. And I don't think that was quite true, but at least it shows what he thought of us. But, of course, our fellows weren't interested in that sort of thing. But then the new president, Remsen Bird, told people, he says, that's terrible having all those fine Christian fellows all locked up together in that one group, he says, they ought to be mixed around in the different fraternities in the college, exerting their fine influence for Christ in all these institutions. Which, of course, really meant getting away from being fanatics and so on. But the way he said it was very deceptive. At that time, they had the practice of having a valedictory address by the one with the highest marks. And somebody asked me 2 or 3 weeks before commencement what I was going to speak on. I hadn't thought yet, so I says, oh, the Siege of Damascus. I thought that was a general enough term to cover most anything I might want to. And when I finished my talk at the commencement service, Remsen Bird sitting beside me says, great speech, Alan, great speech. They used to have the 2 highest scholarly marks in the class speak, and also 2 others, so they'd be sure to have 2 that could speak. So they have 4. And the next year of my graduate year, this professor of English who had wanted us to become a national fraternity, he was trying to get the students to ask to do away with that instead of have a good speaker from outside. And he thought it'd be so much better. So he was talking with someone, and I was with him. He was talking with us, urging that. And I guess he got just a little heated with the discussion and went beyond what he should have in. He says, many a time, President Bird has said in faculty meeting, anybody could get a hand out of that kind of an audience like McRae did last year with a plea for the old faith. But he says, there'll never be another Alvin McRae on the Occidental College platform. But then, Alvin McLean had 2 years of college, and then had gone to seminary, and then I think he'd been a missionary. And then he came back, and after I left Occidental, he went there and took his last 2 years, and he was valedictorian. And I was in the audience. He was later president of Grace Seminary, founder, in fact. And when I heard him, I said, poor President Bird, there's another Alan McRae on the Occidental College platform. When you think of it, there were probably, let's say in 1900, I wouldn't be surprised if there were 300 or 400 small colleges in this country founded by different denominations, founded to train people for the ministry and giving good, sound Christian teaching and turning out good, sound Christian ministers for many different denominations and also turning out good Christian businessmen and leaders in various lines. And of those Christian colleges, 300 or 400 of them at that time. See, there are a lot of new ones founded in recent years, but of those, I doubt if there are 30 of them that are still Christian today. They've just taken them over. You said you mentioned there were other strict rules governing social life at Occidental. Did this hasten or retard the advance of liberalism or have nothing to do with it? In general, what do you think strict rules of conduct does to the total educational experience at an undergraduate school or at a graduate school? And I believe that that question has to be answered entirely in relation to the previous life of the people involved. That is, people who have been accustomed to being strongly regimented continue easily to be. And it's a natural human instinct to look for a leader and follow him. But people who have not been regimented, who have been allowed a great amount of freedom, find any regimentation, whatever, very difficult to take. And so as far as social life at Occidental was concerned, I didn't mean to say that there were strict rules in the sense that things were regimented. Simply that the general attitude that Christians had at the turn of the century was that dancing was wrong, and that smoking and the use of alcohol were not desirable. There's much freedom today that wasn't then. But it was not an institution where they had strict rules, you must do this, you must do that, but it was just understood that those things weren't supposed to be. Now there was developing this looseness, and in some of the fraternities I think the life was rather loose in a way. But they never, when I was there, for instance, would have a dance openly under the patronship of one of the fraternities or of the school itself, though many of them would off the campus. But in the average small college today, a person who tries to hold to rather strict Christian ideals of life finds it difficult to find companionship. Because there's so many things that are just done by everybody, most that he just can't participate in. People don't understand him, and he's apt to be sort of left out of those things. Well, there was none of that there, you see, at that time. There was developing considerable looseness, but the girls all had their own dormitories or their own sororities. Each had a house mother, and they had to keep track of when they came in, and if they stayed out late too often, they'd probably talk to them. It wasn't like some schools where they have to be in at a certain hour and that sort of thing. As I say, it depends on a person's background. And, of course, there are individuals. I think most individuals rather readily submit, provided they don't have too sharp a change. But there are some individuals who just don't want to submit to anything. When Faith had been going a very few years, I noticed a great need of further stress on public speaking. And I introduced a public speaking elective. And I tried to give individual help to the students. And I believe we developed some principles that are still used in our courses here, and that those who took the elective got a lot of good from it. I think eventually those principles got into all our homiletics classes. I was very anxious every student should get these things that I thought would be very valuable to them. One of the main things I introduced was this stress on the different types of variety of volume, variety of pitch, variety of speed, and particularly the most important but the hardest to get, variety of expression. And I have regressed tremendously myself in regard to all of these. I haven't been emphasizing it, and I've gone backward, you know, but I'm sure I did the students a lot of good. But Dr. Laird had the required course in homiletics, and that was almost entirely on the arranged planning of sermons and so on. Didn't go into public speaking, didn't need to speak on. And there were two or three times when Dr. Laird had to be away for a week, and he would say, I think I'll have to call off my class next week, skip it. Well, I announced that the class in homiletics, such and such a class, would meet with the public speaking elective. And so had them meet with my elective and gave stress to training in public speaking. I remember one fellow there, two fellows, who refused to come.
They were awfully nice fellows, too. Nice fellows, good Christian fellows, but they just wouldn't come. And I said, well, now, the course in homiletics is meeting with the Polish people. Like, that's not homiletics, that's public speaking elective, they said. Well, I said this. The homiletics class, Dr. Laird can't be here. And why shouldn't we hold this? And I tried to show them what I was trying to give, what would be valuable to them, and so on. And finally, one of them said, well, he said, if we don't have to come to it, he said, if it's a voluntary matter, he said, we'll come. I was amazed because I never would have picked those two fellows as being fellows who would take such an attitude, but their attitude just was, I'm not going to be forced into anything. And it was such a silly little thing, and I got irritated by that time. I said, oh, don't bother, please. So they didn't come. I think it had been better for their good, perhaps wiser for me to have taken advantage of their willingness. Now, there was one fellow who went to Bob Jones and graduated there, and he came to faith. You know, at Bob Jones, they have their strict rule, no griping allowed, signs all around. In all the dormitory rooms, there are signs, no griping. In fact, one fellow who was there a year told me one time he came out of a chapel service, and he happened to say to another fellow, say, that fellow was sure long-winded. That speaker was long-winded, wasn't he? He said a few minutes later, he was tapped on the shoulder, please come this way. And they called him in, and there were the head administrators of the school. They said, Mr. So-and-so, if you don't like it here, you don't have to stay. But I think that they turn out a lot of fine Christian fellows that are helped by the regimentation they get there. But there's some react wildly against it. And this fellow, he was in our dining club at Faith, and Mr. Taylor told me how this fellow was always knocking the food. Oh, this was terrible. This stuff wasn't half cooked, and this wasn't well fixed. There weren't enough of this, and so on. He was always knocking. Taylor said, he turned to one day and he says, was the food at Bob Jones a lot better than it is here? Oh, no, he said, it wasn't half as good as it is here. Well, he says, did you criticize as much there as you do here? He said, I never said a word against it there. I'd have been thrown out. I guess he had that thing in his system he had to get rid of, and so he didn't dare there. So when he got to us, he took that attitude. So that as to rules governing social life, you have to pay attention to what is the general situation around you. What is the situation of the people before they come to you? What's their attitude toward the school? Now, I was at Cornell to speak to a student group 15 years ago, and I was with a couple of fellows there, and they were having a couple of girls in to supper with them there, and they said their rule was girls mustn't go above the first floor. Is that a rule now? You
know? I'm sure it's not.
No rules now, but that was evidently the strict rule then. The girls mustn't go above the first floor.
There was talk a year or so ago at school here about a possible dress code, which seems to have died down.
Yeah. Yes, I'm glad you mentioned that. That is a tough problem. And when I was at Westminster, I remember one of the fellows there, a graduate of Princeton University, I remember his talking in the dining club about how we ought to dress better. He says, we are a, I forget the word he used, for awful-looking lot or something like that. Every seminar I've been connected with, it has been a problem. The juniors come in, and they have the impression that they should wear ties, at least they used to until the last few years. They should wear ties and a jacket and so on. They do that for the first couple of weeks. And then they find that the upperclassmen are going around looking like hopeless, most of them. And pretty soon they get just as sloppy as the rest. And I have seen it tried for 40 years to try to get students to realize, of course, if you're going to do slum work, it doesn't matter what you're going to look like. But if you're going to represent the Lord in any kind of a place where people expect you to have a certain dignity, you can't just change overnight all your habits. And therefore, that it would be a very wise thing for people to try to get habits in seminary that they can keep up when they're in the Lord's work later on. And so I have always felt it would be a fine thing if students would be thinking of themselves as training for a future profession
in which they have to have certain habits, and it's a lot easier to try to have those habits now. But I've never seen any success in 4 years, so I've rather lost hopes of ever accomplishing much in that regard. But we had one fellow who was, I think, one of the sloppiest fellows in the whole seminary for his first 2 years here. His clothes just looked sloppy, that's all. He never had anything but a shirt, no tie. It looked very sloppy always. He got a church out in western Pennsylvania. Mr. Harding recommended him to, and the elders of the church suggested to him they give some money to Biblical, and he told them that he questioned whether it was wise because Biblical didn't have a dress code. I've been told that he has since mellowed somewhat in his attitude. There was one fellow, a graduate of Bob Jones, who they say was a very excellent preacher. I never heard him preach. They said he was a very excellent preacher. And he came from a very, very strict fundamentalist group in Ohio. He came from the leading church of this group. And when he had been here a year, he became quite disgusted with the fact that we were not out knocking modernism all the time. He didn't think we were truly separated. And he didn't think the students dressed the way they should. He propagandized very strongly the next year or two for a strict dress code. But he wrote a letter to the pastor of the church telling how disgusted he was with the seminary. And then that man copied it and sent it to several of his friends. It got a bit of a distribution, that letter did. And then this fellow came 6 months before his graduation. He wrote to his church and asked if they would have an ordaining council meet in order to examine him, to ordain him, and whether it was one of their churches where he could become pastor. And they wrote back and said, in view of what we've heard about the institution, why, we would recommend that you come and be a member of our church for a year, and we could watch you and decide whether you were one that we ought to hold the ordaining council for. Well, I said, to what are you going to do that? Are you going to do that? No, he said, I'm going to look for some other group. So he left the group. But I thought it was served him right. But now Mr. Harding recommended him for a nice church where he's doing a fine piece of work, and Mr. Harding's held meetings in his church recently. Though I did hear a year or so ago there was question whether he would support the seminary because we didn't have a dress code. Well, one of our directors, I think, would be very much happier if our fellows dressed much better. He told me one day, he said, I was up at Princeton and I saw those Princeton seminary fellows. He says, they really look sharp. Well, I can't quite believe they didn't when I was a student there. It's hard for me to think there's such a tremendous difference. But, of course, there is this about it, that during the 60s, there was the whole rebellious attitude in colleges. I know a fellow who taught in a small college in the Middle West, and he said the last years of the 60s, it was just agony to teach the generally rebellious attitude everybody had toward everything. But, of course, now that's largely changed in the colleges. And so we were getting from the colleges people who had the attitude of trying to be as sloppy as possible. But now the colleges have moved much more in the direction of thinking of the future and of being more careful on such matters. And the unfortunate thing is, if we're under the influence of the colleges of 5 years ago, and then people compare us with the colleges of today, it puts us now at a disadvantage. So, like I said, I can't give the answer to it, but I can give a few thoughts about it.